Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the catastrophic 2008 implosion of America's free market economy empower the nation's political right and weaken the left? In his openly liberal critiques on political and economic policy in the United States, my guest has been disappointed in both the Republican and Democratic parties and astonished by the popular support enjoyed in the current climate by those who insist the surest way out of the slump is to further reduce government spending and especially government regulation. Thomas Frank is a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal, monthly contributor to Harper's, and founding editor of The Baffler. His book, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Times Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, is now available in paperback. Thomas, welcome back to Think.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm doing well. So you describe the current celebration of unfettered free markets as a sort of utopian view of capitalism. How has that thinking persisted in the face of so much evidence that people are suffering?
That's a really good question, isn't it? I guess the way it works is for the people who are the sort of spokesmen for or the people who long for a kind of unfettered capitalism to basically wash their hands of what capitalism has done in the past. And that sounds, you know, the way I describe it, it sounds, you know, cynical and everything. But this is actually something that you can observe happening all the time, to simply say, well, you know, all of those terrible things that happened in 2008, 2009, you know, the financial crisis and the bailouts, those were not the works, those are not the fruits of capitalism because we never really had a pure free market system in this country, which, you know, by the way, is true, okay? And you know, you sort of go from there, the idea being that if you did have a more pure free market system, then you wouldn't have, you wouldn't have economic catastrophes like that, which I think is false.
So if we live in a time of class warfare, which I realize is open for debate, but your sense is that the upper class has managed to characterize itself as the greater victim in this. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that. I just had come across my computer screen a little while ago in an email from, you know, that linked to a statement issued by this billionaire in Florida who was talking about how he, you know, if Obama gets reelected, he's going to have to lay people off. And it's there's all of this sort of whining, you know, emanating not just from this guy, but from lots and lots of very rich people in the last couple of years, generally having to do with the Obama administration and particularly focusing on the president's rhetoric, which, if you ask me, has been, you know, has really been quite tepid. But there's this sort of, I mean, there's a sort of genre of this sort of complaint, you know, complaints from the very rich about how hard the world is. Now, I don't know if I don't know how many people, you know, believe this stuff, or how many people agree with billionaires that they're the great victims of, you know, of the present circumstance. My guess is not very many people would, but what I focus on is the fact that this genre even exists. And by the way, it has kind of an interesting pedigree. The novelist Ayn Rand, right?
Yeah, the movie comes out on Friday.
This is one place where I did not see the original Atlas Shrugged movie. I just read the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of missed out on that, and I feel bad about it. So I'm going to have to make up for it and watch the sequel when it comes out.
I can't imagine what people think if they see you in line at that movie.
Oh well, no. I don't know. maybe I've been converted. I did read all of Atlas Shrugged, you know, and it's quite a long novel. I deserve some sort of prize for that, I think. It's but one of the plot of Atlas Shrugged, and by the way, it is a very interesting book, and it's something that you have to read to understand conservative thought in the current sort of never-ending slump that we're in. And I'm not saying that it's a particularly good novel. You know, it has its points, that sort of thing. But it's an interesting novel, and it's an instructive novel. And one of the things that it's instructive about is, okay, so the characters are these sort of tycoons, these captains of industry, And they are they're the producer class. You know, they speak of themselves as the ones who and in fact the novelist recognizes them as the ones who have built everything worth building in America.
The so-called job creators is what we'd call
them. That's what we call them now.
Yeah.
And at one point, one of these billionaires is talking to another one of these billionaires, and he says, you know, we are society's true victims. And it, you know, goes on from there, this kind of whining, you know, self-pitying way of talking. Now, truth be told, Ayn Rand never pitied anybody. She was a, you know, hard, mean Nietzschean, right? The pity is not one of her emotions, one of her, you know, favorite emotions. But that's really that's where the idea for the book came from, was these guys thinking of themselves as society's great victims. And do you want to hear why that's so important and why that's so meaningful?
Absolutely.
Because it's a reversal of, and this is really interesting to me when I figured this out, that it's a reversal of your sort of classic laborist way of understanding the world. By laborist, I mean like
Stalinist literature, right?
In the 1930s, yeah, mm-hmm. Proletarian literature of the 1930s. The way the sort of worldview that became common during the last sort of unending economic slump, by which I mean the Great Depression. So in the Great Depression, it was really common for people to salute blue-collar workers as the people who built America. You know, that's, in fact, that used to be the sort of staple of Labor Day speeches that politicians would give. And Ayn Rand in Atlas Shrugged sort of sets out to turn this idea completely on its head. So you have not just, you know, these billionaires claiming that they're the ones who built America, but also going on strike, right? And that's the plot of the book. You know, I don't want to give away too much here, but that's the plot of the book. The billionaires go on strike and they bring America to its knees. This, you know, ungrateful nation that won't recognize their achievements in the way, you know, and has this government that supports this sort of moocher class, you know, far larger than 47% of the public. This government that just steals from these worthy billionaires. Anyhow, that's where all these ideas came from, both in the political world that we're in now, and also in my own book, Pity the Billionaire.
But Thomas, I mean, let's look at it this way: doesn't America need both to succeed? Don't we need the laboring class, and don't we also need those who are at the top, sort of orchestrating the development of private industry?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you'd say, I mean, you have to have a financial industry, if that's what you're asking me. You have to have investors, you have to have capitalists, you have to have, you know, some intelligence, putting the money here and there and investing in things, of course. The question is, I think, is the rewards that go to, you know, the rewards that go to the different parts of society nowadays, and also, you know, are you going to just allow things to, I mean, are we going to regulate this or supervise this in some way, or are we just going to let things run like we did with the housing bubble back in the last decade?
So let's talk about the way the two parties are communicating with their constituents and potential constituents. There's this sense that the right stepped up, and you write about this, and sort of positioned itself as the new populist protest movement, and the left somehow didn't step up to the plate on that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think when people get that impression, because that impression is largely, I don't want to say it's true, but that's certainly the way things seemed in 2008 and 2009. You know, you had the financial crisis, but then, you know, before the country really had a chance to think about what had gone wrong, you had this outrage that in some ways was even greater than the outrage of the financial crisis, and that's the outrage of the bailouts. You know, which is a separate chapter, but basically, you know, the Wall Street banks get themselves in terrible trouble. You know, these with all packaging up these, you know, toxic securities and all this sort of thing. You remember all that story?
Yes.
And then, of course, they get off the hook with help from their good friend Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary in the Bush administration. And then his strategy, the bailout strategy, is then embraced by the incoming Obama administration, and. So it's something that you can lay at the feet of both parties. But what the conservatives did was something very interesting, which is to, you know, when the first chance they got, which is when Paulson took TARP to Congress in 2008, the first chance they got to say anything about this, they distanced themselves from it, the conservatives in Congress. They voted no on this. And that was a very appealing thing to do. I mean, I remember at the time, you know, everybody was saying, well, they've got to do the responsible thing. But the fact is the public hated the Wall Street bailouts, and I think for good reason. You know, they were an abomination. And conservatives took that opportunity to sort of start their comeback. Now, you remember in 2008, not just after the 2008 elections, but even before that, the pundit class here in Washington, D.C. was basically convinced that conservatism had run its course, you know, from the days of Reagan up until the days of George W. Bush, and now its time was over. They had pushed too far. They'd gone too far. They had, ended in economic disaster, after the disaster of, like, Hurricane Katrina and the disaster of the Iraq War and all this sort of thing. And the pundit class here in Washington was convinced that the Republican Party needed to move back to the center. You remember this kind of talk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every newspaper columnist was saying this. And the Republican Party did a very interesting thing when they were, had to figure out how to respond to their own very difficult straits in 2008, where they'd just been beaten in pretty badly in the national election. What were they going to do? And their choice was to move further to the right, to call for a sort of purified form of capitalism, to blame the disasters of the Bush era on, insufficient purity, okay? Insufficient ideological purity. George Bush wasn't a real conservative, they said. Real conservatives would have never bailed out the Wall Street banks. And so the answer was to move further to the right. And here's the really interesting thing, Chris, is that this strategy worked. This is exactly the opposite of what every pundit in America was telling them to do, and it worked.
Well, how much of that was because of the rise of the Tea Party movement, which, in fairness, is really not about necessarily elevating the wealthy. It really is, at the purest heart of it, the Tea Party movement is about reducing government spending across the board.
Yeah, that's one of the things that they say. But the Tea Party movement originally sprang up as this kind of expression of outrage over the bailouts. That was the original trigger. That's what yelling on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade. I'm sorry, I've forgotten. I blanked out on his name. No, he's a CNBC commentator who sort of launched the whole thing. And it was about the bailouts, and it was during the bailout outrage. And I happened to go to the very first Tea Party rally, and it was about a month after Barack Obama had been sworn in, had become president, and they were out in that park in front of the White House. And, waving signs. And, I went down there. I was a columnist for the Wall Street Journal at the time. And I went down there both because I was curious, but also because it was, I wanted to see what was going on, what people were going to protest about in this hard times that we were in. And I was, I don't want to say surprised, but what I saw there was all of your sort of, usual conservative movement figures, a couple of years before, you'd see them at panel discussions and conferences and stuff like that. But now they were down in the park with bullhorns and placards, and I thought that was kind of funny and kind of amusing, and I sort of laughed the whole thing off. But I also remember seeing a sign that somebody was carrying at that rally that said "Let the failures fail," and it showed the logos of the various big banks, and I kind of agreed with that. that was the mood in the country. I mean, I knew intellectually, or whatever you want to say, I knew that you couldn't just let the economy fall apart. But also there was a certain appeal to that.
Thomas Frank is with us. He's a monthly contributor to Harper's and founding editor of The Baffler. His latest book is called Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Times Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Haney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Thomas Frank. He's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal, now a monthly contributor to Harper's and founding editor of The Baffler. His most recent book is now out in paperback. It's called Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Times Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Thomas, how do you think President Obama has failed as a communicator of his own vision?
I think, I don't even know if it's if he. I don't think he has failed as a communicator of his own vision. I just think his own vision is is really inadequate to the task at hand. Clearly, what we needed in the environment of 2008, 2009 was a kind of Franklin Roosevelt figure. And there were a lot of, there was a lot of comparisons at the time between Obama and Franklin Roosevelt. People thought that's the direction he was going to go in. But instead, he sort of made himself out to be, the second coming of Bill Clinton. Constantly trying to strike a grand bargain, as he likes to put it, with the Republicans. Now, he's completely failed at being the bipartisan president, but not because he didn't try. This is what he really wanted to be. This is what he really wanted to do. If you go back and read his memoir, his second memoir, The Audacity of Hope, which is about him running for the Senate from Illinois, he talks in there, about conciliation is basically the great theme of his entire life. That's what it's all about. It's always coming to some kind of compromise with the other side. Everybody coming together in some kind of agreement. That's what he really believes in. He doesn't believe in the sort of what you and I would probably think of as the principles of the Democratic Party. That's not what it's about. He's not some kind of liberal, liberal warrior or something like that. He's a born conciliator. And I think that was, I was one of the many people who at the time in 2008 thought he was going to be a great president. And certainly his rhetoric, his rhetoric was very soaring and very inspiring. But he didn't really do it. I mean, you go down the list of his great achievements, and they were things that I agreed with. The things that he did are things that in general terms I agree with, like the stimulus package. That was a good idea in my view, his effort to get some kind of national health insurance. I certainly agreed with that. I mean, he wound up taking a Republican plan that he had got from the Hoover Institute, but it wasn't that. It was the Heritage Foundation. That's the, sort of the origins of his healthcare plan, and that's what he used. And his great mistake, or I think his great sort of character flaw, has been his endless desire for conciliation. And we can go into why that's a mistake if you want. I mean, obviously, because it's just in terms of straight up game theory, that requires the other side to want to conciliate also. And if they can see that that's your strategy, obviously they play the game very differently, and they constantly move further and further away from you, off to the right, and you have to chase after them, and that sort of thing. And so it never really worked out. The other great mistake, and you saw this especially in the debate with Mitt Romney the other night, is more of a rhetorical one, and that is that Barack Obama is really entranced by the idea of technological expertise, of academic expertise. And whenever he had to justify something to the public, in the course of his presidency, it was always he always would justify it in terms of, experts and professional expertise. Why do we have to have this giant stimulus package? Because the economists tell us we have to have it.
Well, this is as academics are wont to think, right?
Yeah, well, that's right, and of course that is his background, mm-hmm. right? University of Chicago.
Right.
He was a. In fact, I went there as well, and he was a professor there when I lived in that neighborhood. He was my state senator. But yes, that's exactly his background, and that's my background too. But you got to realize something like the the stimulus package. This is a highly controversial thing. People don't, you know, the logic of deficit spending is not self-explanatory. This isn't something that's just obvious to everyone, you know. This is something that you have to go out and sell. You have to tell people why we need to do it this way, you know, why it's a good idea to run up a gigantic deficit when everybody seems to think that, when it seems it's a natural reaction to say, well, in hard times you need to tighten your belt. And, you know, but no, he wanted to do the stimulus package, which I agreed with, but could only explain it in those terms. Same thing with health care, you know. It's always to fall back on the authority of experts. And, you know, look, this is a democratic country, and I know that experts are experts, right? I went to graduate school. I know all about that. You know, I understand the source of their expertise and why we should respect it. But this is also a country that is, you know, it's a democracy. It is this is a profoundly democratic country. And you can't just tell people to accept something because the experts say we need to do it this way. And what's very interesting about, you know, the Tea Party movement and the sort of revival of the right generally is that it was the opposite of all that stuff. It was populist. And by the way, this is, you know, this has been my theory about the right for years and years and years and years. The reason they succeed is because they have this, they constantly fall back on this populist language, populist way of understanding things, very populist rhetoric. And you saw this especially in the Tea Party movement. And that there's something that is really profoundly moving about that at a time of, you know, economic crisis.
Well, talk about this, because for a while, in fact, a year ago, the segment of our profession that likes to have exactly two sides that are exactly polar opposites, there was the Tea Party, and they were so excited that the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street movement had arisen. And that has really largely faded from major impact at this point. What was the Tea Party able to capitalize on and work with that Occupy Wall Street wasn't able to sort of coalesce and make happen?
Well, I actually just finished a big essay about Occupy Wall Street and why it failed.
I wish I'd read it.
Story, but I think the main reason that you see such a divergence is because of the kind of forces that aligned themselves with the Tea Party movement. The Tea Party movement, for one thing, I just finished describing it as being intensely populist, and it was in terms of its rhetoric and, you know, its organization and stuff like that. But it was also largely trumped up by the various groups that I described here in Washington D.C. It didn't just spring out of the earth fully formed, right? Mm. It was set up by these various pressure groups here in D.C. Various magazines and lobby shops and that kind of thing. That's who was at that very first rally. And it also, it really helps when you're building a social movement to have a TV network behind you. It turns out that's a really helpful thing. Fox News was immensely helpful to building this movement. Another thing that we don't often remember when we think back to that climate in 2009 was the influence of Glenn Beck. Remember, he had this TV show for just a couple of years on Fox News, but it was hugely important to these people as a sort of organizing voice, organizing ideas. So the Tea Party movement started out, and it sounded very open-ended. You know, it wasn't going to be part of a political party, or at least it didn't seem like it was. It was going to be, anybody could sign up, anybody could go to one of these rallies. Or that's what they would say in the early days. But, of course, it wound up just being folded back into the Republican Party. I think one way to evaluate the Tea Party movement was as a kind of strategic move by the groups that we traditionally identify with the Republican Party. And the reason they did this is because the Republican Party itself was pretty much played out by the end of 2008. Its brand, if you will, was very badly damaged by the Bush administration. And so if there was going to be a revival of conservatism, it obviously had to come from somewhere outside of the Republican Party.
I have to say, watching the debates, one thing that caused my jaw to drop was when both candidates, the Democrat and the Republican, referred fondly back to Bill Clinton and tried to align themselves with his newfound popularity. Did that surprise you?
Well,
I mean, they were quoting Clinton almost like you heard, you know, the sort of revival of Ronald Reagan 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, they're both doing it for their own reasons. But, of course, we look back to the, I mean, that's to be expected because we remember the Clinton era as an era of prosperity. You know, this was the great dot-com, you know, bull market. You know, this. I was never particularly a fan of Bill Clinton, you know, at the time. But I can. That's easy to understand, and we think the same thing about the Reagan era. That was also a time of prosperity, and so it's this kind of become in retrospect this sort of hazy, you know, happy time that we can all look back on and imagine that we were part of. You know, I look back to my childhood in the 1960s, and you know, it was a prosperous time, and think of that as having been, you know, a really wonderful time in America, although, of course, we know that everybody was fighting like cats and dogs back then.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Ian on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ian.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually had a question about two sort of what I perceive to be diametrically opposed ideologies on the right about Christian values and the Ayn Rand sort of selfishness as a virtue. But I also wanted to just comment briefly, since you were on the subject, about the difference between the Tea Party and the Occupy movement. And getting back to what your guest said, obviously the support of Fox News really helped the Tea Party. But the biggest difference that I saw is that the Tea Party essentially had police escorts, and Occupy Wall Street essentially had the police cracking down on them at every turn, every opportunity they had. That's sort of the biggest difference that I perceive. But I was wondering if you could perhaps talk a little bit about these two ideologies on the right and how to square those without cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Thanks for
calling. Well, that's a really good question. And the caller also makes a really good point about the two movements. I mean, obviously your movement is not going to, you know, you're going to have trouble if you're, you know, constantly getting beaten and tear gassed and stuff like that by the police. That's not, you know, you're going to have to develop some sort of strategy for dealing with that. And Occupy never really did, you know. But that's a story for a different occasion. The cognitive dissonance, that is one of the things that really puzzles me, because you know, Ayn Rand, as we all know, in addition to being this novelist that certain business types really like, was also one of the leading atheists of her day. And is, you know, is highly critical of organized religion, basically, specifically meaning the sort of Western religions. I don't know what she had to say about Eastern religions, but the ones that are familiar to us, you know, highly, highly critical of the of these religions, and in some ways following Friedrich Nietzsche, who is, she never claimed Nietzsche as the source of her ideas. In fact, you know, didn't want to have anything to do with Nietzsche, but Nietzsche was also, you know, really critical of religion. And how is it possible to do to both love Ayn Rand and separate yourself from, you know, and at the same time claim to be, you know, religious? It's very difficult, if you ask me. But this is, you know, there are many similar things like this that political movements get around. The contradictions never become manifest. You know, they never break through into people's consciousness. I think it's very easy for people nowadays to pick and choose the facts that they want to believe, and not just facts, but the sort of elements of religion and ideology that they want to accept, even when those things are contradictory.
Well, I mean, Ayn Rand's atheism notwithstanding, there are people on the Christian right who say, we absolutely believe that charity is important and that we have an obligation to the poor. We just don't believe that obligation runs through the government. It has to happen as a matter of individual choice and people working through charity.
Yeah, but even, I mean, I'm not going to let these people off the hook here. You know, render unto Caesar. Come on now. You know, the government is government. I don't want to get into these arguments here because I like you just said, I understand that these things are endlessly debatable. You know, I grew up in Kansas, in the suburbs of Kansas City, and you know, I remember people could use the Bible to rationalize virtually anything. I was always amazed by that, but you know, that's the way it is, and I'm not going to argue with it.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Dennis on the line in Southlake. Hey, Dennis.
Hey, Chris. Dennis McQuestion. How are you?
Wonderful. Thanks for calling.
Good. I didn't get in on the first of it, but I used to read Tom's column all the time in the Wall Street Journal. And, Tom, I'm a friend of Steve Moore's, so you might know where I'm coming from this issue. We have a television program on Channel 13 or the PBS station for the last 23 years. And in the last year, I've had the Tea Party on and the Occupy Wall Street people on. And I think you really mischaracterized things in several ways. And let's talk about one. Your previous caller, Chris, said this, that the Tea Party was, you know, was didn't have the problems with the police that the Occupy did. The Tea Party didn't take over any public space. They didn't mess up everything that was happening. They didn't take over the place in New York City. They just had movements that they had permission to do and talk about these issues. It wasn't an Occupy Wall Street where a bunch of squatters were out there trying to do things that were illegal, and that's the big difference.
Well,
secondly,
let's get...
Let's
get a response to that. And the phone line's not great, Dennis, so I'm gonna move off from here. But I think we've got your point, at least on the first one. Will you respond to that, Thomas?
Yeah, well, that's certainly correct. I mean, the Tea Party people generally took pains to get permits, you know, to have their rally in the park. And Occupy obviously didn't have a permit to occupy that park. You know, that's certainly correct.
My guest is Thomas Frank. He's former opinion columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Now he's a monthly contributor to Harper's and founding editor of The Baffler. His new book is called Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Times Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. We will return to this conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, presenting Secrets from the White House Kitchen, lecture, book signing, and hors d'oeuvres, October 16th with Chef John Hanney III. More at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Thomas Frank. He's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal, now a monthly contributor to Harper's and founding editor of The Baffler. His newest book is called Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Times Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Thomas, to the extent that many on the far right in this country tend to sort of blame all of our problems on the activity and existence of government, or too much government, I should say, doesn't the far left do the same thing with sort of capital C corporations and blame corporate America and private industry for many of the things wrong with the country?
Oh, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure you can find people who do. The, you know, the what I would caution you against, Chris, is this idea of, you know, this of a parallel universe where everything is, you know, everything has its neat analog on the other side.
Equal and opposite reaction, uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, and everything is equivalent to something on the other side of the mirror. It just isn't that way. I mean, we're living in a conservative era, and, you know, we have been, depending on how you date it, you know, from the late 60s or from the early 1980s. You know, and the great sort of historical movement of our time is towards freeing up markets and deregulating and deunionizing, you know, that sort of thing. It's not in the other direction. And so that's what intrigues me is that great sort of historical movement sort of came very close to pushing the world off a cliff, and yet now has completely, not only completely recovered itself, immediately recast itself as a populist rebel movement, and picked itself right back up and took over the House of Representatives, and is just still going. I mean, they got one of their own on the Republican ticket as the vice presidential candidate.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Ron in Fort Worth now. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on one thing the speaker made, that yes, it's not clear-cut. I'm a progressive. I primarily vote Democratic. I'm also a CPA and a chief financial officer of a company here in Fort Worth. One of the things that I've always noticed is that the myth-making and the fairy tales of the far right are really effective, and even your caller may have drank some of the Kool-Aid on that. I was here in the 1980s, and our economy here in Texas was absolutely abysmal. It was actually, in my opinion, worse than what we've seen since 2008. And yet the far right always glamorizes that and says that was the wonder years of the Reagan Revolution. That particular crisis came across because of the Glass-Steagall Act being repealed from, it was a Depression Act from the 30s that allowed banks to get outside in savings and loans the traditional confines that they had, and basically allowed them to make incredible investments that were highly risky. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
I know where you're going with this.
I mean, I'm saying what...
Because you were in Texas in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. The SNL fiasco. It was all the same stuff.
So what do you think about all that, Thomas?
Well, no, the caller's exactly right. I mean, that's like, he should read Penny the Billionaire. This is the first... The evolution of the book, it came... I mean, this book is my response to the financial crisis and the bailouts. And the book sort of arose after I read all the literature of the financial crisis. This fascinated me, and we cut him off before we got to hear what he was going to say, and that was my own fault. I should just keep my mouth shut.
Well, we've still got him on the line.
He would work for people that went to jail.
Yeah.
That are still in, two of which are still in the federal prison system.
But you're talking about the SNL, the SNL fiasco, right?
Correct.
Yeah. It was the exact replay of the financial crisis. All the same stuff was going on, and it was because they deregulated the SNLs in the 1980s.
But this time nobody went to jail.
The same way. You know, it desupervised them. The regulatory agencies were captured and were totally asleep at the switch. And these insiders at these banks were just able to loot their institutions. An amazing thing, and we seem to have learned nothing from it. And we seem to have learned nothing from the latest financial crisis. And this is one of the points that it's so important to get across. And this is, by the way, we're talking about Barack Obama's various failures. The fact that he's never even tried to get this across, that we've done almost nothing to make sure that this never happens again. You know, in the 1930s, you know, that's sort of one of the signature gestures of the 1930s was that we passed all kinds of laws in this country to make sure that the insanity of the 1920s could not happen again, and we haven't done anything like that this time around. Barack Obama doesn't really believe in it. You know, that's not where he's at, and it's also, by the way, not where the Democratic Party is at anymore. There are good Democrats here and there who still believe in, you know, regulating banks properly and maybe in even breaking banks up, which is what should have happened after the financial crisis. But certainly the president doesn't believe in that, and none of his economic advisors believe in that.
Why did no one go to jail after the 2008 meltdown when, you know, as our caller mentioned, he knows people who are still incarcerated for the SNL scandal?
That's right. You're asking a big, big, big question here. I would say, you know, what the people in the government always say is that, you know, you'd be amazed at what is legal in this country. And there is some truth to that. I mean, we're talking about a system where these banks were basically able to write the laws regulating themselves and were able to I mean, you look at one of my favorite regulatory agencies from the Bush era. It was called, when I say favorite, by the way, I mean, you know, most degraded. It was called the Office of Thrift Supervision. And the head of this regulatory agency once posed with a bunch of bank lobbyists. They're all standing there together in front of a bunch of rule books covered with red tape, and they'd all brought various gardening implements to show how they were going to slash through the red tape. The guy that's in charge of the regulatory agency has brought a chainsaw, you know, to show what an enemy he is of regulation. This is the guy that's supposed to be regulating the banks, you know. you know, that's why, I don't know. You ask, why does nobody go to jail? There are all sorts of crazy, actually people do go to jail, but it's generally the people who borrowed the money. You know, the most obvious violation is, of course, what they used to call liar's loans, which is fraud on the face of it in its very name.
Right, okay. not providing documentation of, say, income
right.
before
they
you take it.
You just
alone.
Give people give anybody a mortgage. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of people that took out the mortgages, plenty of borrowers who have been prosecuted, lots and lots and lots of them. As to whether any of the big banks have been prosecuted, because I mean, obviously it takes two to, you know, to do something like that, and there's good reason to believe that most of the fraud was on the, you know, other side of the desk, you know, in the senior bank management and stuff like that, who are handing out these loans that they knew were fraudulent in order to hit bonus targets. You know, that's the incentives. That's the way it worked in the last decade. We know that was going on, and very few people have been prosecuted for that. As to why, I mean. I hate to say things like this, but it's obvious and it's staring us in the face. It's because these people own the system.
What about this? How significant is the fact that many Americans who are smart people but have lots going on are not entirely sure what's meant by credit default swaps and derivatives and toxic assets? Is part of the problem that people don't fully understand what got us into trouble?
Yes, that's exactly correct. And you know, I didn't know what a credit default swap was either. And I was a columnist at the Wall Street Journal when all of this stuff happened. And I remember taking this sort of these crash measures to try to figure it out. You know, calling up experts and having them walk me through it to try to understand it. And you know, for the public to not understand it is very natural and very normal. But here's the funny thing about that confusion and about the price of never figuring it out and never getting it straight, is that sort of baseline confusion allowed all sorts of other confusion down the road. And I'll give you an example. When Pity the Billionaire first came out in hardback, it was back in January. I went on a book tour. I went all over America. And what you do when you're an author on a book tour is you do radio shows like this one, and they take callers, like as you've been doing. And every radio show I ever did, I would get these callers who would say the same thing, which is, but we know that the financial crisis happened because Bill Clinton made the banks give out loans to poor people. And I would say, well, you know, I don't know anything about that. I've heard the conspiracy theory before, but there's no evidence for it, so, you know, what can I say? And I would shoot it down as best as I could, and I would hear it again in slightly different phrasing the next day, you know, in some other city. You just hear this constantly. And so when all of the actual means by which the crisis happened are completely incomprehensible to us, we make up these other explanations that make more sense to us, you know, even if they don't have any grounding in reality or have a very slight grounding in reality. I mean, there is some grounding for that particular conspiracy theory that I just described about Clinton forcing, you know, there is some grounding. It's not much, but, you know, but that's what we turn to is things that cognitively make sense to us, but don't have anything to do with the facts at hand.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Ellen on the line in Louisville. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I just would like to respond to the previous caller when he compared the Tea Party and the Wall Street occupiers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big difference. The Tea Parties are millionaires, and the occupiers are graduate students who are unemployed. So there's a huge difference, and I need to kind of share my opinion on that. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point. The caller's right about By the way, you know, I didn't go to Occupy Wall Street, but I, like I said, I just finished this long, long, long article about them, and I read all of the sort of literature of Occupy Wall Street, and she's described them fairly accurately. It is students, largely graduate students, a lot of professors. And this is actually one of the weaknesses of Occupy, in my opinion, is that these people often, the occupiers, the protesters, often would sort of conflate what they were doing with the theories that they were interested in graduate school. And this is the kind of you know, literature that they produced is just soaking in this sort of high theoretical stuff. So, by the way, one of the reasons that it didn't, in my view, one of the reasons that it didn't catch on is precisely because of that, which is unfortunate because I think students have every right to be protesting in America right now with tuition prices doing what they're doing.
But with all due respect to Ellen, I'm not sure it's accurate to characterize the Tea Party as largely being
made up of
millionaires.
Yeah, that's not exactly correct. And I went to a bunch of Tea Party rallies. That was something that I did. And the impression that I came away with was not so much millionaires, but definitely prosperous people. And what I finally decided was the sort of social stratum that most of them came from, or that a preponderance of them came from, was small business. And you often would see small business organizations, you know, at Tea Party rallies making presentations, proclaiming solidarity with the Tea Party movement. In particular, I'm thinking of the NFIB, which is the National Federation of Independent Businesses, mm-hmm. Which has become much more prominent political player, you know, just here in the last couple of years. But that was my impression of them, was not rich people necessarily, but not struggling people either. But instead, small business people, which, if you think about it, explains an awful lot about the Tea Party movement.
So do you have like a bowl of popcorn at the ready for the vice presidential debate?
Is that tonight?
I believe it is. Tomorrow night.
I'm going to tape it. Paul Ryan fascinates me because he's a very intelligent guy, which is kind of unusual in politics. But he also, usually says what he thinks. Okay, and he's going to have to, obviously running for the vice presidency, he's going to have to change his tune. But you know, an actual Ayn Rand quoting objectivist running for the second highest office in our country, that's really something else.
And anything particular that you're expecting from Joe Biden?
Well, he'll be his usual self. I don't know.
Will Biden be any better at sort of characterizing the desires of the Democratic Party than President Obama was?
I think Biden is. Truth be told, I just have not given a great deal of thought to Joe Biden for a really long time. By and large, I'm always fascinated by these Republican vice presidential candidates. I think of Sarah Palin last time around. She was much more interesting than Biden. I don't know. I just can't get excited about Joe Biden.
Well, we can tune in tomorrow. Maybe you'll find out. Thomas Frank's new book is called Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. It's now available in paperback. Thomas, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can find out about upcoming programs and download our podcast every day at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.